Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Here now is War Telescope, presented each week by the News and Special Events Department of NBC. But before we go overseas, a word of warning from your government. Many of you, no doubt, are planning a big vacation this summer. But before you do, stop and think. Railroad and bus lines are carrying the heaviest passenger loads in their history. In addition, tons of supplies and millions of men are being moved from the European theater to the Pacific. The result? There just isn't enough room for any civilian travel. Wartime travel is not only unpatriotic, it's downright uncomfortable. So, friends, take your country's advice and don't travel. And spend your vacation the comfortable way, the patriotic way, at home. Now waiting in London are John McVane and Wright Bryan of NBC's foreign staff, ready to give us another insight into Europe today. For that story, we take you to NBC in London.
This is John McVane in London. The other day, I was walking through a blitzed area near St. Paul's Cathedral. Bombs had knocked down a wide stretch of buildings. The bricks had disappeared, and dust had spread over the ruins. Now grass was growing on the debris, grass and flowers, yellow daisies, and a flower that waved purple blossoms on its stalk. At first sight, if you were passing by quickly in a bus, you wouldn't think of the empty space as being anything more than an ordinary vacant lot. You could hardly be expected to visualize the cauldrons of solid flame that boiled over that section of London unless you'd been there and seen it. Sometime I expect they'll build it all up again with perhaps neat little bronze plaques on the new buildings to mark the sites of the historic old buildings that disappeared in London's bombings. But meanwhile, nature is doing its best to conceal what men did there so short a time ago. When I drove through France recently, the same thing was happening. The roads in places were gouged with little holes, cup-shaped depressions. Unless you knew, they looked like ordinary bad roads that shook your car and jarred your teeth unless you braked down quickly. But if you'd been there or had seen other roads that looked the same, you could tell that here a strafing plane had splattered the road with cannon fire. Nearby, you'd perhaps see the rusty remains of a burned-out truck lying on its side in the ditch. On another stretch of road, you could pick out the regular holes where a belt of mines had been laid and lifted. And perhaps farther on, you'd see how an armored column had passed over the road, tearing out pieces of McAdam. And you remembered the jouncing rides you had had over just such roads so many times in the past. In places, you still see the remains of German guns knocked out in the fields. In one, 8 or 10 Sherman tanks, burned and rusty, stand all within 100 yards or so. You stop the car, look around and see what happened, how the tanks must have been caught as they entered the valley by a battery of German guns in the flank, the guns you passed a mile or so back. In France, as in London, nature is dimming, camouflaging the signs of war. Some bomb craters are grass-covered. The green grass overspreads all the traces of fire and shells and tank treads, so the tanks seem like isolated monuments on the green slopes. Along certain roads, signs still warn you not to move away into the neighboring fields, for thousands of German mines still remain unlifted. The American troops passed through quickly without taking up all the mines. No one could possibly take up all the mines, for some couldn't be detected by the mine detectors. For years to come, here and there over parts of France, a cow will suddenly disintegrate, or a pair of lovers strolling in the moonlight will disappear in an explosion they'll never hear. And the countryside will remember the Boche who tried to conquer Europe. But when travel again becomes easy, and perhaps ex-soldier husbands or fathers take their relatives to France, it'll be hard for them to bring back the picture of gigantic armies struggling and fighting to the death. For the hills will be just hills like any others, and the 88 guns will have been picked up as scrap metal, and there'll be nothing to recall the country lanes that threw gigantic dust clouds up when 1,000 tanks and vehicles thundered by. And in the quiet Normandy hedgerows, there'll be nothing to recall the machine gun fire and the mortars. Here in London, as on the continent, in spite of the flowers that grow in the bomb craters, there's little of the relaxation you might have expected at the end of the European war. The British people are being told that their rations will be shorter. They'll get less food this next winter than in any winter during the war. Potatoes and other staple foods are hard to obtain. Clothing is shoddy and scarce. The government still controls all labor. Transport's short. Tired people form tremendous lines to get standing room in a bus. London is crammed with returning prisoners, soldiers on leave, and people who, after living 4 or 5 years in the country, have moved back to town. Some of the British army men are to be demobilized. Britain has made a tremendous effort in this war. It wasn't able to waste anything. The peril was too great. So the men of 52 who were called up for the army can expect to get out soon, and by Christmas, soldiers of 40 or over who want to become civilians will be back with their families. Every Britisher who makes $2 has to pay $1 in income tax. So far, there's no real indication that this will be lowered, although now, just before the election, some of the politicians are referring to such a possibility very, very coyly. The British women who are drafted into the services are also going to get a chance to become civilians again. On Monday, several hundred British Army women are going to be released from Army service. They're all married. Each one will get the equivalent of $50 and 56 clothing coupons. Those 56 coupons mean she can buy a suit, 2 dresses, and a pair of shoes, or maybe a coat, a dress, and some underwear and handkerchiefs. That isn't much clothing to begin civilian life when the dresses you wore 4 or 5 years ago are eaten by moths or were given to a relative. The political fight is going on hammer and tongs. To show the unity of British foreign policy, Mr. Churchill invited the Labour leader, Mr. Attlee, to the next Big Three conference. The move was exactly the same as President Roosevelt's naming leading Republican leaders to the San Francisco delegation. Whatever is said about it in the election, you can be sure that the British are united in the fight against Japan and in their overall foreign policy. But meanwhile, the three main parties, Conservative, Labour, and Liberal, are using every weapon in the election battle. The Liberals are the most restrained. They may pick up quite a few seats, but they don't hope to become a majority party. Even with the powerful aid of Mr. Churchill, the Conservatives will probably have a hard fight if they're to hold a majority of the House of Commons. They must win by a fairly good margin, or they'll find themselves overthrown by a Liberal-Labor coalition. On the other hand, the Labor Party still hasn't settled its internal affairs. The leader of the Labor group in Parliament is Mr. Attlee, a mild, genteel type of man, but not the fighting type many Laborites think they ought to have as Prime Minister if they win. Yet he may be a compromise between the rival claims of such men as Ernest Bevin, the former Minister of Labor, and Herbert Morrison, who was Home Secretary in Churchill's national government. It's strange to be talking about an election fight in Britain where for 10 years there have been no national elections. The Parliament that dispersed yesterday was elected 10 years ago. It served under 3 kings and 3 prime ministers. I won't be here to broadcast about the British elections. After 7 years in Europe, 6 of them years of war, I'm leaving England for home next week by boat. I came during the tension that preceded Munich. From September 3rd, 1939 until May 8th, 1945, I was never out of a war area, never home nor in any neutral country. So for a change, it'll be nice to look at Europe from a distance and be in my own country again. But the men who'll appreciate getting home most are the American prisoners of war. The man who knows best how ex-prisoners feel is Wright Bryan. Wright Bryan was wounded and taken prisoner while he was covering the Third Army for NBC and the Atlanta Journal last September. After months in R Flag 64, he was freed by the Russian Army on the 22nd of last January. He was evacuated by way of Odessa and wound up in Paris. He's just left the first general hospital near Paris after 10 weeks of treatment for a wound that refused to heal. But now he's well and looking forward to flying back home to Atlanta, Georgia next week. How do you feel about going home, right? Seems a long time since that day we saw the liberation of Paris together last August, doesn't it?
It certainly does, John. A lot's happened since we watched the German tanks being shelled in the Tuileries.
What do you look forward to most, besides getting back to your wife and those 2 pretty girls and your boy?
I think I'll vote for Georgia watermelon, John, and some southern fried chicken and buttered biscuits. Take 2, you know, and butter them while they're hot.
What sort of treatment did you get in that American hospital in Paris? It must have been pretty good because you look as though you'd put on weight.
I have, and I needed it, too. We had mostly battle casualties in the hospital when I first went there. Recently, we've had a stream of Kriegers suffering from malnutrition.
What's this term, Kriege, you all use when you speak of prisoners?
It comes from Kriegsgefangenen. German for prisoners of war. The Kriegers usually stay in hospital a couple of weeks to get back their health before they fly home.
Do you think imprisonment has had any permanent effect on them physically?
It hasn't had any permanent effect on most of them, thanks to the Red Cross food parcels. Without those food parcels, there's no telling how many of our boys would have died from starvation of the diseases that come with malnutrition.
I know very well how the Germans starved our men. But do you think it's had any effect on them mentally?
No permanent effect. It has made them want stern treatment for the German people. They've been terribly indignant at the stories from home about how German prisoners in the United States have been pampered.
Do they talk much about their experiences in the prison camps?
Not much to other people, but when they meet another Kriege, they always compare notes. They ask about conditions at one another's camps and how they were liberated. At the hospital, where incidentally I had a doctor from Atlanta, Major Charles Reeser, an old friend, I met some of the prisoners from my own camp that I hadn't seen since January. We were about 1,500 in all there. All except 91 of us who couldn't walk were moved out on January 21st. The Russians freed us on the 22nd. The others were marched 350 miles across Germany and finally liberated by the Americans.
I suppose they get some leave when they get home.
Oh, yes, 60 days. Unless they were in very bad shape, they're pretty well restored physically by the time they get back to the States. When they arrive at that hospital in Paris, they get a special diet slip that gives them meals of high vitamin and high caloric content. Those boys were so starved, they go down and eat 2 and 3 full servings at every meal. And 1 serving is more than enough for a normal eater.
That's pretty good. I suppose they get pretty good care in the hospital.
Wonderful care, John. The first general had 3,000 patients when I went there. In 2 years in the ETO, they've looked after more than 26,000 patients, battle casualties, sickness, and liberated prisoners of war. And in all that time, they've had only 23 deaths. The care of patients is top-notch, American doctors and nurses and French nurses helping. I don't think anyone at home ought to worry about the kind of care our boys get in American Army hospitals.
Well, maybe that'll be a comfort to some of the people listening, right? And pretty quickly now, both of us will be home for that get-together in Sea Island on Maine.
The sooner the better, John.
And so I return you, for the last time, to the United States.
Now here's some news from the NBC newsroom in Radio City, New York. The Pacific fighting centers in the hill and cave battle on southern Okinawa, where the Japs are starting suicidal charges, and where General Buckner predicts the end within a week. But the Japs are worried about possible invasions of islands between Okinawa and Japan, and say coast defenses of the southern homeland are going up at top speed. And on Borneo, where the Brunei invasion has yet to meet serious resistance, the enemy forecasts new landings at the great oil center of Balikpapan. This news is coming to you from the NBC newsroom in New York. The Chinese are attacking their invaded seaport of Wenchao and have regained the offensive west of Liuchao in the China Corridor. There's another enemy report of a 3-day raid by American carrier planes, then a shelling of Truk in the Central Pacific. The European highlights this afternoon. Press reports say that Archbishop Francis Spellman of New York may be the next papal secretary of state. Also, the unofficial report that the Belgian king, Leopold, is about to return to Brussels, that the present Belgian government is resigning. In London, Lord Hoho is back to face a charge of high treason. Spaniards in Paris have denied that a train attacked by Frenchmen carried troops of Franco's Blue Division, which fought with the Germans against Russia. London hears that one of the duties of the American occupation forces in Europe will be to photograph every hill and dale in Germany. The Air Force will do the job to provide the Allied High Command with a strategic map for invasion in case it's ever again needed. In Paris, it's been learned that Britain formally has rejected the French demand for a 5-power conference on the Levant. That's the War Telescope for today. This afternoon, you heard John McVane and Wright Bryan speaking from London. Jim Waldrop speaking from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.